Hi, welcome to our second Marfa Dialogues. I'm Fairfax Dorn, Executive Director and Co-Founder of Ballroom Marfa. This is Hamilton Fish, publisher of the Washington Spectator. We started this program in 2010 because of our interest in intersecting the cultural arts with critical journalism and social issues. Our first symposium addressed the complex issues of the border of the U.S. and Mexico. And after the success of our first dialogue, we decided to make this a permanent part of our programming. Each year, we host a symposium, and a subject is inspired by a visual arts exhibition. And this year, we are extremely fortunate to work with David Buckland of Cape Farewell on artists' response to the climate challenge. And I hope you all have a chance to go visit Ballroom Marfa to see the Carbon 13 show. And I just also want to thank everyone who's been involved in making all of this happen between the Carbon 13 and the Marfa Dialogues. First, our participants, they've come far and wide to be a part of this amazing program. And also our extraordinary partners, the Washington Spectator, the Marfa Public Radio, the Big Bend Sentinel, the Marfa Book Company, and the Dixon Water Foundation. Also, none of this would be possible without the support of the Rauschenberg Foundation. They were the lead sort of funder, sponsor of this entire weekend and visual arts exhibition, and we're very honored and proud to be a part of their new initiative. In addition, we are grateful to the Andy Warhol Foundation, to the Brown Foundation, to the Texas Commission on the Arts, the Dixon Water Foundation. We have a lot of great foundations that supports us. Frederica Hunter and the Crowley Theater. And I know I'm missing some, so I'm gonna look for a second. The National Endowments for the Arts, very important. The Public Concern Foundation and the Foundation of Contemporary Arts, and most of all, our members. And foremost, our staff and everyone who has worked tirelessly and very hard to make this an amazing and incredible event. And I'm very honored to be working with everyone I do at Ballroom Marfa and with Marfa Public Radio and the Crowley Theater. But I'm going to pass you off now to Hamilton Fish at the Washington Spectator, and he's going to carry on.
Well, let's thank Fairfax Dorn. She always wants to go first because she doesn't like to be embarrassed, but she really has, along with the team at Ballroom, made it just a tremendous achievement with this event, and it's evident from the first minute what a great thing the dialogues have become. My simple assignment was to introduce Rebecca Solnit, who's the moderator for this panel, and I was in a natural fashion going to read a few sentences from her biography in the inside cover of River of Shadows, her latest book, and there are just parenthetically a lot of books by authors associated with the dialogues on a table in the lobby, and all of you are encouraged to support the dwindling arts and buy some books today. But in typical fashion, Rebecca, who pretty much rebels against even the most modest authorities, instructed me to take a look at an online biographical sketch, and I'll just condense it for you before this computer goes out. Writer, historian, and activist, Rebecca Solnit is the author of 13 books about ecology, environment, landscape, community, art, politics, hope, and memory. Most recently, the best-selling Infinite City, a San Francisco Atlas. Many of you are familiar with A Paradise Built in Hell, A Field Guide to Getting Lost, Hope in the Dark, which I was proud to publish a number of years ago at Nation Books, Untold Histories, Wild Possibilities, Wanderlust, a river of shadows. Let's hope that this list continues on forward beyond today and the dialogue. She is also a recipient of a Lannan Literary Award, which is, of course, a larger project that all of us in Marfa are familiar with. Great pleasure to introduce Rebecca Solnit, our first panel, and thank you all very much for coming. If you gave up the funnel cakes and the sausage on a stick, and you're really missing them, we'll be taking a break between now, this panel and the next one. You can shoot back up to the courthouse and get your share.
Thank you so much, Ham. It's a huge pleasure to be here. I want to thank Aaron particularly, who thought to invite me, and Ham, who actually had my email address, although he's also about to introduce me with a bio from 2003 before I intervened. And you know, it's just great to be here. I wanted to introduce my fellow panelists. We each thought we'd make a short statement at the outset. Then we wanted to invite you to come forward and make statements, pose questions, frame the situation as you see it. And just in the few days I've been in Marfa, I've met a lot of people working with community land trusts, working on the land itself, working with Occupy Marfa, engaging with these things in really interesting ways. And we really want to hear from you and make it a little bit of a general assembly or community forum, although I remain the moderator. So, and anybody who wants to speak, don't be shy. It can't possibly be as bad as being up here. There are microphones on either side, and because this is being broadcast on television and radio, please come up to the microphone so your voice is recorded. So I want to introduce Amy Balkin, who's interested in land, geopolitics, environmental... Oh, they moved them. Amy at the end. Geopolitics, environmental justice, and questions of how people share or don't share common pool resources. She lives in San Francisco and teaches at California College of the Arts. And next to her, in case you couldn't guess which one, David Buckland founded the and directed the Cape Farewell Project, which brings together artists, scientists, and educators on journeys to the world's tipping points to collectively address and raise awareness about climate change. So he's an artist of some of the pieces in the show at the Marfa Ballroom, and he curated the exhibition. And he's sitting next to Adrian Colburn, whose recent work consists of large-scale installations comprised of layers of hand-cut paper, digital prints, and projected light that investigate the complex relationships between human infrastructure, earth systems, technology, and the natural world. These works, derived from scientific data, images and video collected through research and while participating in scientific expeditions, look at how mapping is used to investigate fragile and inaccessible ecosystems along the edges of the Earth's last vestiges of wilderness. Like me, like Amy, she lives in San Francisco. I'm thrilled to be on a panel in Texas that's dominated by a San Francisco woman. And with that, who wants to start?
I will start.
Thank you.
So I guess I'll just begin to give a little bit of context of the kind of work I do, maybe how I came to it, and what I'm doing here. I'm originally from Chicago. I studied art as an undergraduate. I was a painting student who did sculpture and eventually moved after I graduated to California and became, as many people are, really fascinated with the landscape of California. And one of the things I would do is drive back and forth on the I-5 between San Francisco and Los Angeles. And it really made me begin to think about landscape. What do we look at? What we don't look at? What do we see? How do we sort of imagine an unbroken landscape? Do we sort of visually blot out the bits of infrastructure that break this image that we have? You know, whether or not that's a romantic landscape or not. You know, I think it's very individual. And as I became more interested in it, I became more interested in maybe what I didn't see, which would include people that I couldn't see along the I-5. And I went to graduate school, and when I was there, I took a course that was for people who were doing field work in communities that were unevenly impacted in terms of pollution. So communities that were experiencing environmental degradation and siting of things like waste incinerators. And my two concerns came together in thinking about how I might be able to collaborate on a project, and worked in collaboration with other artists in doing an audio tour of the I-5 between San Francisco and Los Angeles. And it was an audio documentary that was really activists, people who were doing dairying, and many different concerns that came together along the landscape, including specifically looking at the air basin that is California's Central Valley, because it's ringed by mountains. Things stay there. There's intensive agriculture. You know, there's methane from dairying. There is a lot heavy pesticide application. So you have this air basin, people living in it. What does that do? And also, too, how does the history of California create this sort of entrenched political interest that may or may not affect actually air quality, who's more affected, and, you know, the impacts for people just in terms of their physicality, you know, whether or not that's asthma, whether or not that's other kinds of hazards for health, breast cancer risk, and how that's distributed. So I worked on that project, and that was really thinking about a local community, but then became equally interested in questions of the environment at a global level. So as opposed to thinking about a specific public, thinking maybe about an imaginary public or an imagined public and climate change, these questions of the entire atmosphere. And I began a project called Public Smog, which was an effort to open a clean air park in the atmosphere. And I've been working on that in a few different iterations, the first which was to get involved with emissions trading and try to get involved with regulated emissions markets, first in California, then in Europe, buy the right to emit pollutants that are normally reserved for companies that do pollute, and withhold those from use, and then create this temporary clean air park, depending on the pollutant and depending on, you know, what part of the atmosphere that occurred in. So I did that project, and eventually, I'd say through that, I met David, who invited me to travel with Kate Farwell in 2007 up to the Arctic, which I was really happy to have a chance to do. But it also, in that, you know, it's really hard to sort of understand questions of the atmosphere and understand our relationship to the atmosphere. I think going to the Arctic also made me think, well, you know, you can't really necessarily see the impacts of climate change. So how to understand them and how to understand how they're distributed. And the project that I've done here in Marfa is a project that explores these questions in a different way. And it's a project that's a mapping project. It's a participatory map that's just beginning, and it's called A People's Archive of Sinking and Melting. And what I've asked is for people who live in places that may disappear based on the combined economic, political, and physical impacts of climate change to contribute an object to this archive, thinking about whether or not where they live may disappear, and that these things may represent something that may no longer be there. And the reason I organize it this way, and it's just beginning, and if you live in a place that you feel may disappear, an invitation is open to anyone in the audience or anyone they know to contribute to this archive. This idea about the politics of self-mapping, right? It's you who decides whether where you live is impacted and whether or not it should be, it may disappear. So it's really up to people whether or not they contribute to this. And so I'm hoping that it has a sort of network effect, in that you can actually get a sense of sort of self-representation through objects of perhaps something that may or may not happen. And I think that's difficult to foresee. So that's a little bit about what I've done here and a little bit of what I've done in the past.
Am I jumping straight? Okay. About 15 years ago, I'm working as an artist, and as an artist you follow lines of inquiry and things come up to you and you kind of chase them down. And I started working with some climate scientists and mathematical modelers. And it became very apparent to me that I was suddenly given a huge bank of information that actually was of serious concern to not only or interest to me as an artist, but also serious concern to the way we actually inhabit on the planet we live. And we had to find a new kind of kind of balance in a way between human ambition at the same time as the kind of the demands of the natural systems. What also came apparent is that the scientists were working and they knew the information in the way that commonly we know now, but they couldn't get it out into the public domain. You know, it was very difficult for the media to pick up on such a dialogue, and it was very, people resist if kind of pure scientific data and information. So when I kind of started the project, I thought, well, okay, maybe there's a different way of telling the same story or creating a language where you could actually approach the subject and the information of the scientists and actually do it in a different way. So I started and programmed an expedition into the high Arctic. And we did it aboard a beautiful old schooner, which was very telegenic. And we put a crew of 20 artists and scientists together. Now, what is the luxury is that the scientists were working in the field. I mean, this isn't a scientist working when they get back to the lab and using the information they've got. This is how they get the information. So oceanographers, atmospherics, geologists, the whole range of scientists we've worked with. And then the artists would just kind of embed and kind of sponge up that kind of information and try and transfer it into an artwork, a narrative that actually would resonate. Now, I kind of thought, well, this would just be one or two shot, would do it, and that would, I can carry on my artistic practice in my own vein. But it just became so, the response from the artistic community was huge. The response from the scientific community was just totally engaging. And at the same time, we did resonate. We started getting stuff out into the media and we started making exhibitions. And when I say artist, you've got to go through the whole creative estate. So you had architects, you had writers, filmmakers, musicians, opera directors, poets, as well as fine artists, sculptors. So that's the whole range that we took up. We did about 9 expeditions into the Arctic. We've done one into the Andes, to the headwaters of the Amazon. Recently, we've been working with island communities on the west coast of Scotland. And again, it's the same principle, and we're also working in urban environments now. And the idea, again, is always for the artist to interrogate the world and to find ways of teasing it out. I mean, I think one of the things, in order to, this kind of begs 2 questions. Is this a valid activity for artists to engage with? Because it is an issue, and I think this is going to be part of the debate today. And the second one, is it effective? In terms of valid issues, artists always, they kind of, one way or other, they reflect the time and society they live in. And it's very obvious that, one of the biggest kind of questions floating out there is this big notion of climate and think how things are changing. And it's now, it's becoming very apparent, huge droughts here in America, the ice is melting in the Arctic, wettest summer ever in England, all over the planet, there's very destabilized weather systems, and it's not a one-off, so this is going to accelerate. So therefore, for the artists, valid comment, how do they engage? How do they interrogate this information? And I think the Cape Foil program has sort of developed quite a sort of sophisticated program of expedition. And that's how you kind of take information, something kind of called action-based research. This is information that is a future truth. I mean, the thing about climate is even if we change all our regulations today and we actually manage to decarbonize our cultures, the knock-on effect is still 20 years. So it's a very difficult subject to pick up. And that's where the process has gone on. In terms of a success, Ian McEwan's last book, Solar, was inspired by one of the journeys he came up with. And it was interesting from that one, they gave him 10 minutes of primetime television news to talk about climate. It was only because, A, Ian was who he is, but secondly, he had a way of having a conversation with the public and on TV news that actually was in a different way of giving the information out, humanizing the story in that sense. And, there's recently been an opera done, which was part of the Salisbury Festival. It's in the Salisbury Cathedral. And it was extraordinary because, in a way, not only do you kind of perform in this, quite extraordinary festival that is the Salisbury Festival, but you also bring in subjects like eco-theology. and the notions of belief and faith, and how does that language then come into? So again, artistic inquiry, we're bringing in a whole strand of other kind of thinking and ways of being. There's a whole range of successes. We've got 3 shows on the road at the moment. We've made 2 feature films, 1 for the BBC. You know, huge audiences. A Russian playwright wrote a play for the World Service again. You know, 15 million people. So there is an enormous appetite for people to kind of come into this kind of dialogue through the arts, and they've been a very successful way of talking about it. And I think it begs. One major question is, where is the disconnect? You know, why is there a disconnect between the reality that we're beginning to understand is climate change and the actually, you know, where is the willingness to engage with it and find creative ways forward? And is it an opportunity not to make it something that is all negative, it's going to impact on our lives and we're all going to do less, but can we find a way of framing this so actually the future is better and it's more exciting than the place we live in, which I truly believe. So that's the Cape Vale project, and I can talk about myself as an artist somewhere down the line. But hey.
Hello. So my work for the past several years has been based largely on an interest in how we visualize the world around us through technology, photographs, and maps. And that has had a lot of different permutations. Many years ago, I started on projects that dealt, in some ways, in related to what Amy was saying, dealt with the ideas of landscapes and what you can see versus what you don't see in the landscape. So I did several projects having to do with urban infrastructure, like sewer systems and the vast networks we rely on and sort of take for granted that also have a little bit of an abject quality to them, oil refineries, pipeline systems, that sort of thing, the kind of man-made infrastructure that we really rely on in the day-to-day, but don't necessarily want to have part of our day-to-day landscape that we gaze upon. Although having flown over Midland and then driven around, I now see that that it actually is kind of more integrated in Texas, which I think is quite interesting. So I had, while working on those projects, there was an underlying theme of being very interested in environmental issues and what was happening to the climate, even as long ago as 10, 15 years ago. And that kind of, I sort of pointedly sought out a way to look at how the act of mapping related to climate change in some way. And of course, there's predictive maps and models, which are interesting, but also have sort of a visual flatness to them, in a sense. And I did a few projects that kind of took scientific data, like from the Snow and Ice Data Center, and used those for some works that I did. And then I kind of latched on to some more political themes, looking at the Law of the Sea Treaty and seafloor mapping and the mapping of the Arctic for the first time as the ice retreats and makes that space more accessible. And I ended up on the U.S. Coast Guard icebreaker, the Healy, for a month with this Center for Coastal and Ocean Mapping at UNH, and spent a month manning the sonar along with the scientists and shooting photographs and video and really getting to be more immersed in that seascape that feels a little bit like a landscape. We were in ice the entire time. And trying to wrap my head around the complexities of the issue with this team of geologists that were able to visualize the seafloor, with a, sort of see it for the first time, and understand the geology of the Arctic for the really in a way that hadn't been understood in the past. So as we were sort of driving through, the floor of the ocean was coming up on the screen and kind of realizing, oh, this is the first time a human being has sort of seen this, although seeing more through sound, through sonar. And then also thinking about what the ramifications of that were. So a map is kind of the gateway to to conquest, right? That's the first thing for when staking a claim. You make a map, you plant your flag, you do that kind of preliminary visualizing of space. And kind of drawing that out and making a drawing is the first step in opening something. So that kind of the fear of having a little bit of knowledge as also being a can of worms. So that sort of started me off on a long series of expeditions that I've done. I was invited after that to go with Cape Farewell to the Andes and Amazon, which was an amazing experience. We spent about 3 weeks traveling through Peru, starting at the headwaters of the Amazon, one of them, a glacier, at 13,000 feet, and then working our way very slowly and a lot of the time by foot down to the Amazon basin and tromping through the jungle, slogging around with scientists from the Environmental Change Institute. And as they were measuring trees in a plot of land to try to get an understanding of how much carbon was stored there. I think there's someone from the Environmental Change Institute here today. So so that experience, those two experiences kind of set me on a course. I've been up to the Arctic another time looking at kind of microbes in the sea ice off of Barrow, Alaska as the permafrost melts with scientists from UGA, where I'm a professor in the University of Georgia in Athens, and then also out at sea in the Amazon plume with them as well, looking at little diatoms that are sequestering carbon in that kind of complex area of the ocean. And then also in Costa Rica with an entomologist. So I've kind of spent a bunch of time with scientists watching them collect their data and seeing how then that gets presented and wondering a little bit about that process of throwing a bucket in the ocean and counting the zooplankton and then deducing what's going to happen to our climate and seeing kind of the visual models that come out of that. So that's kind of where my work's been coming out of those expeditions. On most of them, I've shot a lot of photographs and video and made work, then brought it into my studio in probably a slightly more traditional form, you know, locking myself in and working long hours alone, and making works that look at, or at least my process kind of is all about elimination, like what you're going to eliminate in order to illuminate something else. And I think a lot of science and art has that in common, where in order to present something, you kind of strip everything away except for these imperative pieces of information and lines. And through that, you create a narrative, and at times a fiction, usually a fiction. And I think I'm really curious and interested in what happens once you have to sort of edit everything out except for, you know, these little bits of meaning. I think I'll stop there.
Thank you. So I decided to write mine. It goes better that way. It's my natural language, the written, not the spoken. So one of my most fundamental beliefs is that culture shapes politics, or rather that politics are the practical and legal expression of cultural beliefs. In that sense, our problems are always cultural problems, and the change so often means changing the culture. In so many cases, I think the cultural change happens first. First, gays and lesbians come out of the closet, advocate for rights, the culture shifts, and then the Supreme Court, state governments, et cetera, start to change the laws that govern our private lives. For example, I'm old enough to have watched some of the most rooted and entrenched beliefs of our culture change about women, about race, about sexual orientation, along with the rise of a more systemic understanding of the natural and material world. I was born the year the Berlin Wall went up, when people thought the Cold War would last 1,000 years. The civil rights movement was young and not yet successful. The Ivy League universities were segregated by gender, and women in this country lacked basic human rights. I'm a year older than Rachel Carson's landmark book, Silent Spring, a book that came at the beginning of thinking about the world systemically, when words like sustainable and downstream and downwind and bioaccumulation and even ecology and environment were not in circulation among ordinary people, though nuclear testing fallout had taught people a lot about far-reaching contamination and its biological consequences. I've seen vast and profound change in my lifetime, though I fear with climate change we need to act faster than those cultural changes of the underlying systems can achieve. Still, I saw the environmental movement transformed again in my late 20s and early 30s from what was essentially conservation, putting fences around pretty places as though they could be separate from everything else, to dealing with environmental racism with whole systems and getting over the idea of wilderness, which was invented by forgetting about indigenous people. Remembering the existence of those first inhabitants or listening to them say that we always were here, we're still here, undid the nature-culture divide and shifted everything. Seeing that ideas mattered and minds could change and that change so often began in the shadows and the margins, even if the people in the limelight at the center didn't acknowledge that, is what made me hopeful. It made me hopeful about my own work as a writer, too. In my 20s and early 30s, I was an art critic, and it was a great arena to learn in. Artists ask the biggest questions about being and making. They do philosophy through the material. They make mute objects speak. And that provided a wide open and generous platform for my own forays into what writing could be. I've done the most direct forms of activism. I've blockaded at the Chevron refinery in Richmond, California, and at the Nevada test site, have worked with Native American land rights movements, have demonstrated and organized and worked with climate and anti-war movements as well, have been part of the great Occupy groundswell that swept across the country a year ago and is still at work in 1,000 ways in 1,000 places in this country and beyond, and have kept my hand in with all those things. Another of my foundational beliefs is that, counter to what I think of as a political flavored art of the 1970s, one's specialized work does not want to exempt one from the rights and obligations and engagements of citizenship. By citizenship, I don't mean your nationality or possession of papers, but your membership in civil society and your participation in public life. It's a right and a pleasure as well as a duty, and part of my literary work has been to describe that sphere and encourage participation in it. So much of my writing is about trying to name and value what is often nameless, unvalued, overlooked, to try to find another way to tell the story, to speak to the private interior emotional life of politics and the ways our hopes and fears, the stories we tell, make the world. I agree with the radical poet Muriel Rukeyser, who said some decades back, "The world is not made out of atoms, it's made out of stories. It's actually made out of atoms and stories. And the stories we need to tell right now are in part about carbon atoms and compounds like methane, black soot, and more in the upper atmosphere." What am I actually doing? The short answer is not enough. What are you doing? What can we do? What should we do? These are the questions that I spend my time on these days. But I want to just end by saying that I also believe in pleasure, that the changes climate change requires of us can be toward more rather than less pleasure, that entirely apolitical art of all kinds can provide the pleasure that sustain people in doing the political work that needs to be done, and that honor, dedication, solidarity, and a life of dignity provide subtle and necessary pleasures that we should talk about more. So, and with that, I want to see if people in the audience want to talk about some of the things that are actually doing in Marfa, the way that this questions about climate change arise for them here, about how they would frame the questions. If I want to hear if there are questions for the panelists or the rest of the audience. So if anybody wants to come forward and use the microphones on either side, please do. And I want to see a full-on stampede. I want to hear the clattering of cowboy boots and stereo on either side of me. Yay. And still they came. That was people just moving around in general. Questions, anybody? Comments? Stories? So I know on radio, dead air is the enemy, but is this going to be edited or is it going out live? live. Okay. Hello, Mr. and Mrs. America and all the ships at sea. Here's Alice from Occupy, Marfa.
Thank you all so much for being here. I'm so excited that you guys are all here, so thanks for everybody for making this happen. I am an artist, but I'm also a scientist. My degree is in marine biology, and I moved to Rhode Island, the ocean state, to study scientific illustration at Rhode Island School of Design because I thought that I wanted to make art about science. But while I was doing that, I got a job as an oceanographer. So I was a plankton collector for the Global Ocean Ecosystem Dynamics Project for many years. And I found that while I was studying scientific illustration and also being a scientist in the daytime, I was kind of walking between these two worlds. Like, I didn't fit in as an artist, and I didn't fit in as a scientist because all the scientists thought that I was like a crazy artist. And all the artists thought that I was like a very technical person. But what I found is that I ended up making art for the scientists themselves because I found that the scientists were not able to express the parts of science that are not part of the scientific method. I mean, the scientific method can be, it's a wonderful thing and it's a very important thing, but it doesn't allow for the magic and the mystery and the inspiration and all of the intuitive parts of science. And that is such an incredibly important thing that tends to be missed, that we tend to try to make science into something very dry and something very impersonal. I mean, part of the scientific method is that we have to be objective, when really part of what we need now is to reconnect with nature on a very deep level. And just to mention Peru, I feel that, I don't know if you had a chance to speak with Quechua people there, but they have a language like Apu, for example, it means sacred mountain. It doesn't just mean mountain. It's not just a feature of the landscape. It actually describes a sacred connection that the people, the Quechua people, have to their landscape. They have other words that are absolutely beautiful to describe tree spirits and water spirits and the word Aini, which we don't have a word exactly like Aini in English, but Aini means sacred reciprocity, and it means that you never take something from the land without giving something back. So even if you're walking on a trail and you find a rock, you don't just pick up the rock and put it in your pocket, you give a piece of your hair, or you find a way to give something back before you take something. So what I'm trying to do with my own work, which is very multimedia. I mean, I was a scientific illustrator, and then I started using sound and sculpture and all kinds of different media to express the miraculous. So really, and I'm on all these panels for the Art and Science Collaboration Society and, you know, trying to merge art and science, but really I'm finding that that's not what's needed. Perhaps what's needed is a third discipline. And Goethe talked very eloquently about delicate empiricism and this idea that there's a third way to, it's not art and it's not science, but it's a empathic, a way of studying the world through prolonged empathic living with nature. Okay, so I'll try to finish up really quickly. I'm sorry I'm taking so long, but I find that a lot of the climate stuff that's going on right now, for example, 350.org has a huge campaign to try to educate us about the results of climate change, but without helping us to connect back to nature. So in other words, there's a lot of data, and there's a ton of data, but really data isn't personal. I mean, Bill McKibben's recent article, Climate Change is Terrifying New Math. I mean, terrifying math really never inspired anybody to do anything. So I feel that we need to perhaps use different language, such as Apu. You know, to our landscape, the features of our landscape are sacred. So how can we all together make this shift that, like Rebecca said, I mean, we don't have a lot of time. So it seems like trying to rebuild culture from the ground up and trying to help people reconnect to nature. How can we do that? How can we, as artists and as scientists, bring this information in a way that helps people to remember that we are all connected? You know, I feel like in the 1700s, when when science and spirituality parted ways, you know, that we started looking through microscopes, and that's when everything became particles, everything became separate. And our whole culture is about separateness. Like somehow that part of science that makes us all feel separate has dominated our entire culture. And I keep hoping that maybe the grand unification theory or something will be proven so that it will make it clear to all of us that we are in fact connected. It's not a metaphor. It's really like every single thought we have affects everyone else. So how can we effect this change really quickly? I don't know the answer exactly, but...
It goes back to something the panelists gathered this morning. We're really talking about empathy versus disconnect. I wonder if you want to speak to what Alice just said, but also to these questions about empathy versus disconnect, about whether this is a cultural problem, whether the scientific data just alienates people or is necessary. And, you know, just a few tiny things like that.
Small, tiny.
In no particular order.
In which order?
Any order you like.
I'm going to pick it up, but anybody is willing to come in. It was an interesting conversation this morning. One of the examples, I mean, I'm going to go slightly off piece from that dialogue, but in terms of disconnect, I had a conversation in Canada with the director or the chief executive of Shell, who was in charge of the tar sands, and it was a very open kind of conversation. And, you know, I personally think the tar sands is an appalling crime on the planet. But it was extraordinary that this guy, super smart, very cultured, knew exactly what was going on, knew exactly the climate argument, and totally believed it. He actually knew what was happening. And at the same time, he acknowledged that sort of trying to extract oil out of the tar that is the tar sands was actually a very damaging process. But then he sort of said, well, yeah, but then there's my job. My job is to actually do this. You know, the stock market, the kind of profitability of his company demanded that he actually make the best job possible of actually extracting that oil and maximizing profit. And there, to me, was this huge disconnect between somebody who was super smart and at the same time doing a job that actually he knew was damaging, but actually, you know, he carried out to the best he could. And I do, you know, in a way, that's an extreme example of disconnect. But I think so many times it comes across to me in any climate debate. And if you even make it to a personal level, it's like, yeah, but you know, I will have to stop doing this, or I will have to rethink the way I'm doing it. And where's the resistance in us that actually says, wait a minute, I don't want to make the step towards a change? And I find that, you know, in a way, how can you take that disconnect and make it into something that is positive, something that is exciting? And I think that's part of the story. And then, that goes on to empathy. I mean, you know, how far can you take empathy? How far out from yourself can you become empathetic? You know, if you come across somebody right close to you who's having troubles, you empathize. But if somebody's in Africa, you know, there are so many people suffering from climate distress at the moment. Do we have empathy towards them? And that seems to be so far removed. But what would redraft our culture? What would redraft our position so that empathy becomes much more of a dominant currency rather than disconnect become the dominant currency? Nobody?
Amy?
Well, I mean, I guess we were having some pre-conversation this morning, and the project that I'm doing is dealing with often, well, thinking about places that may disappear, you know, and there are of course questions of, well, how good are people at adaption? But really, for me, it's a problem because there's a question of like, well, who's forced to adapt? Who has to do the adapting? And some people may, you know, be adapted entirely out of existence. So I was thinking about places that may disappear relatively soon, like, for example, some very low-lying atolls in the South Pacific. So people who are living on low-lying atolls, they are more likely to entirely lose where they live and, you know, be forced to migrate. When they migrate, they'll be migrating from their own perhaps autonomous or somewhat autonomous cultural nations into other cultures where they'll be subsumed, you know, perhaps, or they'll be minority cultures. And so I think this question is, you know, how do we think about the present moment? You know, you may live in a place like right now that's right now experiencing a terrible storm, for example, you know, east of New Orleans, where there's been, you know, I think, was it, where, what parish was it, where they actually had to knock down the seawall to, was it Plaquemines? Right. So the question is, like, you know, different cities have different defenses. People in Natal may be having a problem, and also people may be having an atoll having a problem here, you know, in the United States. So I guess I'm trying to say, how do we not exoticize the experience of people who are maybe more vulnerable to the immediate impacts of climate, but also recognize them as happening here to our friends and relations, and also sort of understand that they're the same. And I think, so there's this question then about migration, right? Who has to migrate? And what does that mean, not just in terms of people's own experience for themselves, for their families, for their culture or potential cultural loss, but really what does that mean for the future? And really thinking narratively, what does that mean about the future of this great story that we would call, you know, human migration? How did we become successful as a species, right? We were able to migrate. And without empathy, you have increased borderization. You have hardened borders, you know, in response to climate change. And you have people who are on the inside, and you have people on the outside, and you have increased injustice. So I think this question about empathy is a question that we can talk about in terms of our own experience, to connect our own experience to people who are close by, who are far away, but also has to be something that, in my opinion, has to be something that motivates us in terms of thinking about a future that is perhaps potentially more just in terms of how the impacts of climate change are distributed or felt. So it's a little bit elliptical, but I'm hoping that speaks a little bit to empathy.
Well, I think that terrifying math has gotten me out into the landscape more than once in life. And that's probably how I ended up doing what I do now is, you know, going back to kind of the role of the artist, there's sort of this traditional artist role of being hauled up in the studio and painting away or whatever. But, you know, getting that kind of direct contact to the natural world or any part of the world and getting involved and really immersed, I think, is one of the most fruitful ways to learn and understand kind of a broader vantage point. And we've created a society where it's very easy to avoid nature. It's very easy, outside of maybe finding a scorpion in your Cuisinart. Someone was just telling me that they had come across a scorpion in a Cuisinart here, which, you know, every now and then we might have an incident like that. But the rest of the natural world is, we have the illusion at least that it's kind of segregated out from our enclaves that we've built. And I think one thing that I've been observing this year in relation to climate is that really for the first time this summer, every time that I've turned on the radio and looked at the newspaper or had a conversation with a neighbor while up in rural Vermont, I spend the summer in northeast Vermont, climate change has come up every day. And I think this is the first time that's ever happened. And it really is about the minutiae and the direct experience. My neighbors having, you know, little comments about something's changed, or there's a introduction of a new species, or something is just shifting. And I think, you know, with kind of what's going on with weather this summer, it's finally something that seems to be on everyone's mind. I guess my concerning question, because I've had a very bleak feeling about this as of late, and maybe for the past few years, is about empathy. I question whether humans are able to make any kind of heroic or even moderate change without a direct, dramatic, personal impact. And maybe that's something we can discuss.
I would say that we have, and we can over and over again. The first great human rights movement was the British anti-slavery movement, and there were almost no slaves in Britain. They were really dealing with the slave trade, with what people coming from Africa to the New World, and et cetera. And somehow it started with, you know, and I do the history of activism sometimes, and I'm a great believer in popular power and the power of dedicated people. 12 Quakers in the 1770s met in a room in London and decided to abolish slavery, which was kind of ambitious. Nobody had ever even thought of abolishing slavery before. It was just, you know, it had been a given. It was a completely different way to frame what was moral and what was immoral and what your responsibilities to your fellow human beings, even those far away, were, and what, you know, and to the idea of changing the rule of law. Only one of those 12 men lived to see slavery abolished throughout the British Empire 50 years later. But all these Britons were brought on board. It became a huge popular campaign and debate. And one of the things that happened was a boycott, a sugar boycott, because sugar was a slave product. And really, you've seen since some really remarkable things. I feel like a lot of the movements of my lifetime, particularly the environmental movements, have been to try and get people to imagine. We talk about empathy always as though it's an emotional virtue, as though it's some sort of innate, you have the feeling, you don't have the feeling, but it's really imaginative. And a two-year-old understands, you know, a two-year-old doesn't need to understand anything. He bangs his finger, he screams. My nephew and I managed to do that to his finger last week. And, you know, it takes a little bit more for him to figure out when you bang your finger in front of me, it also hurts. And you extend through it because your finger must feel the way my finger did when I banged it. And you see that growth of empathy, that it's an imaginative thing. And we're not that, people are remarkably good at not empathizing with the people in the same room as them, which is why we have child abuse and domestic violence, for example. You know, people have a lot of talents for shutting things down. And one of the really scary things about the modern US military is that they've figured out how to override the soldiers' instinctive unwillingness to kill and to make them into killing machines. But they have to work very hard to override that empathy. I think empathy is pretty innate, and that people do have it, but it is imaginative, and they do have to have the data, and it really is a cultural thing. But the environmental movement over and over has asked people to imagine things far away. And so have things like the anti-sweatshop movement was saying, the sweatshirts sold on my campus were made by, you know, exploited children in the third world, and we're not going to wear those sweatshops. We're going to have solidarity with people far away. The apartheid regime in South Africa was brought down partly by Americans, particularly American college students, who decided they were going to take that incredible discrimination and brutality personally and create this massive campaign of divestment. So I think that it can happen. It does happen. I once heard somebody on the radio say that climate change, if you wanted to invent the most difficult possible problem for the way human beings work, you have this thing that's not local, it's not easy to visualize, it involves a lot of science and the terrifying new math, and you have to get people engaged somehow. And, you know, and people have to some extent. And one of the things I think is important to say is that we haven't had nearly enough victories, but we have had victories. 100 coal plants in the United States have been canceled by the actions of the Sierra Club and other groups, fighting them one by one. Emission standards are about to go way up under Obama, although why nothing happened under the Clinton and Gore administration, I've always wondered. There's a lot of victories in a lot of ways around the country and around the world. And I just want to end, before we have a speaker from the audience, with a plug for my wonderful good friend Bill McKibben and the people at 350.org who I work with and admire endlessly, which is that they, you know, I think that a lot of people assume that, you know, going out having great experiences with the natural world and loving it and revering it, et cetera, is something a lot of us do on our personal time, but organizing is what they're there to do. And they're not saying that it's separate or that you don't need to do it. They're saying, like, right now, let's all show up. And they've succeeded in getting people in thousands of communities in about 200 countries to do things simultaneously. And 350 did more than anything to get Obama to back off the tar sands pipeline, which was colossal. If nothing had happened, if nobody had done anything, the tar sands pipeline was supposed to be completed this month. And the fact that, you know, there's some fragments being built with considerable opposition here, and that the whole thing's been kind of upended, is one of those victories. And I think part of feeling powerful is remembering the victories we've had and looking at the power that we retain. But please.
I'm not a scientist. I'm somewhat of an artist, but I'm very interested in this movement. And several years ago, I read Al Gore's book, which inspired me to do it as a personal level. And I'm just wondering how we could inspire, because if every person in this world would get into this, in a very small way, it, as I understand it, it can be halted. And so, how does this panel see that we can take and get individuals? I can just say a few small things I did. I went out and bought a hybrid car. I recycle everything that can't be nailed down. I'm a gardener. I have a compost. That sounds small, but if every person thought this way and really wanted to make a difference, we could make a difference. But how do you see that that could be accomplished?
Do any of my fellow panelists want to respond to that? Sure they do.
Surely me.
David will do it.
I bring it on. I think that's, you know, there's so many things we can do, and it's not that complicated. I mean, there's a little thing in the exhibition where we've always worked with architects. Now, buildings are responsible for something like nearly 40% of the carbon emissions, which is a colossal amount. But it's very, very easy. I mean, they just took a tiny little house in London and an estate and actually reduced the carbon footprint by 80% for a very small amount of money. So quite frankly, it always amazes me whenever, you go to somewhere where, I mean, Texas, look at all this sun and this energy you've got here right on your doorstep. It's very easy to actually create your own dwelling into a completely carbon zero building. You just by importing, I mean, a small investment in terms of the value of the building would actually reduce the carbon footprint of that building significantly. I mean, just solar heating, solar water, solar is the most obvious kind of case. And I've done that to my house. You know, I have a house in France, thankfully. It's very, very beautiful, and I love living there, but it is actually carbon free in terms of the amount of energy that I pour back into the grid and the amount of energy I assume. So I think those little things, I mean, I think it's more than recycling. I think we do have to set it up. And, you know, part of me, there's a strange part. Maybe we're making this thing too complicated, which is maybe there's very, very pragmatic solutions that we can put into place. I mean, it amazes me that Texas is 20% renewables. Now, that's not real. I'm sure that's not done on any ideological basis. But it's actually profitable to actually put in wind turbines. And, 20% renewables for Texas, that's better than Germany. And Germany's held up as the great big green country. So that, it was just done. And I think maybe, with the amount of energy that's sitting here in Texas from both wind and from solar, you could be exporting it in the same way as that oil is exported from the state. So I think, it's just a mind shift. The difficulty is then where's the economic system that makes that profitable, or at least makes it viable? Maybe if you just make the same amount of profit, that would be enough. Then actually it makes it happen. And there's a talk that Tom Rand is going to give a talk on tomorrow afternoon, and that's his territory. And, if we actually manage to decarbonize our energy systems, make the cars more efficient, maybe go to all electric, these are not technological leaps of fantasy. These are actually almost there on the doorstep. We just need to implement them. So I think, if we did that, then maybe all of the other things that we're deeply concerned about, our disconnect from nature, our empathy for other people, would fall into place. It would dominate the way we think about the way we are as human beings. So I think, it isn't that far away. There's a zeitgeist of change that could happen incredibly quickly It does have to happen credibly. I mean, you know, Rebecca's quite right. But maybe the whole thing flips. Even when we're not looking at it, thinking about it, you know, that there's an accumulative kind of need or desire by us all to kind of go woof, and then suddenly we just use all of our technology and our creativity to actually achieve that. And it can happen on a personal level, but it also, you know, let's try and get other people on board with this.
Well, sounds like you're ready to speak to that, Amy.
You know, I have a little bit of a different perspective. And I think it's a very good question, and I think anything that anyone is doing is to, you know, to sort of look towards change or to invoke change is to be, you know, applauded and respected. But at the same time, just based on my readings, my own experiences, I think that I don't know about the time scale, and also, I mean, I guess this is a position that doesn't necessarily offer a solution, but I just wonder about the time scale that we have in terms of, you know, decarbonizing or, you know, making the large structural political changes that need to happen for things to not really, really become very disturbed in terms of, you know, the systems that support life and that support the growth of food that, you know, allow us to be able to access food at a reasonable price around the world, more or less. And I think there's the great questions are, you know, what can't we afford right now? And I would say one thing we can't afford is we can't afford war. We can't, you know, what is the cost? Even if you're looking at it from an architectural perspective, if you're looking at it that way, you know, what is the energy cost of maintaining an infrastructure for the military in the United States? You know, so that's one thing. But I think in a larger context, the question is really like, what are states' short-term interest? And if you're talking, I mean, to just go down that road, if you're talking about capitalism and if you're talking about, you know, states, they're involved in economic war, and I don't know that they can act on the behalf of citizens. So, you know, again, I guess we'll go back to the fact that we need more pressure. And I was in Copenhagen in 2009 at COP15, and I watched a lot of people come there. There was an alternative climate forum called Klima Forum, and there were some really interesting things there. A lot of people who were really very committed, politicized, educated, wanting to invoke all these alternatives. But I think that, you know, it's a very difficult political situation, and I would also argue that, you know, why don't we talk about climate all the time, since it's so much something that's going to dominate our lives in the future? And I would say that that's because of effective politics, and I would say that dialogue is shut down. And, you know, whether or not that's just through people not feeling comfortable speaking about it, you know, whether it's a question of not feeling comfortable having overt political speech, or whether it's a question of, you know, in Copenhagen, of watching people kettled with dogs, you know, if people are not shut down, you know, in sort of in dialogue and debate, they're shut down with force. And I would say that's just because of states' short-term interest. I don't know how we're going to get around that, but for our own existence, I believe that we need to have something else. And unfortunately, I'm, you know, not the person who has a solution, but I'm interested in thinking about how people can work together. And just to add one more thought, I just think that one thing that we can look at is we can look at the environmental justice movement as a successful organization of people who are working with their local, you know, working from the local problems and impacts and networking in a way to sort of say, hey, we have a network set of concerns and these demands are able to sort of make some changes. And I really think that this is a way forward. So I'm not sure how that might work in terms of, you know, the state power, but I'm hopeful there.
Well, one thing that jumped to mind with the sort of question is, you know, often there's pressure put on the individual to, you know, do the kind of common recycling and having a more green lifestyle, or even renovating their home to be more carbon neutral. But without really large-scale systemic and political change, I think none of that is really enough at this point. I mean, that's something we should have thought about decades ago in how we use energy. And we've gotten to a point where, you know, without something that's a much greater upheaval, I don't see how really like that any of the smaller things are going to end up being a solution, outside of the fact that those are, you know, the small things obviously can maybe cumulatively lead to pressure for large-scale change. That said, and we were talking last night around a table, a group of people, about kind of the ability of human beings to look into the future, which is very abstract, and make a change based on kind of prediction and what we surmise through our intellect could possibly happen or may be happening at this point. And I was asking Tom Rand, who's in the audience, if like he thought it was in our animal instinct to be able to make a change just based on that. Because that's always something I think about. Well, we have consciousness and we're able to kind of envision what a future might look like, but are we as like a species well equipped to then make a really drastic change in order to deal with that? And maybe that's a...
You're optimistic.
Right. No, I'm very dark right now.
can I just add one further thought after you?
Yeah, I mean, I think about kind of how we function in relationship to the rest of the natural world. And you know, we really posit this as and we have been in this conversation, as a human problem. And that is what a lot of the discourse is about. But it isn't really a human problem. I mean, it's much greater. And there's... You know, it's much more out of our control, and it's very, very hard to pin down what a solution would be, because there's the science, although we know a lot, I mean, there's a lot we don't know. We are in the middle of an ice-free summer in the Arctic, which I think the first time I heard about that, they predicted it would be like 80 years from now, and now it's, you know, that was 5 years ago or something. So I think we have a very unwieldy animal on our hands. I don't know how well we deal with that.
Yeah, I'll just be short, and I just wanted to quickly think about like so I'm an artist, why am I talking about climate change, and why is it relevant? You could decide that it might or might not be relevant, what I have to say, and my opinions might or might not be well informed, but I think there's a question about, you know, how do we visualize things, and not only art, but other, many, many other disciplines are concerned with thinking into the future and thinking about telling stories and also thinking about working together to create a future. So for me, you know, I know that other people have interests that are not necessarily my own, and they have a plan in mind for a future which is not necessarily the future that I hope to inhabit. So in the work that I'm doing now, I'm really trying to posit models that speculate other possible futures and hoping that other people are interested in joining me in a dialogue about how we can bring those other futures into being. So I wanted to just add that.
I was actually interested in asking all of you both what your best case scenario is and how you see your own work fitting into that. I have to say, you know, I think one of the great things about people changing their lives voluntarily is it really, I think change happens in a lot of different ways. One way is by a kind of contagion, that it becomes normal to compost or recycle, that it becomes normal to live this way. But it also models that these things can be pleasures and they're good, like victory gardens, you know, can be a huge pleasure, not a duty. Because when the right tries to fight us on climate change, they deny it, but they also suggest that it's all about austerity and relinquishing and privation and, you know, and hostile government forces and the UN and their black helicopters controlling your life and taking away your jet ski and stuff. And, you know, but just to suggest that actually our lives could be deeper and richer living the way that might actually work in this regime. But I have to say that, but I don't think that personal change is adequate. We've raised the temperature 8/10 of a degree centigrade so far, which we used to think was not that big a deal, but the whole entire surface of the Greenland ice sheet melted this summer. We've broken thousands of record temperatures around the world this year and just in this country. It rained at 109 degrees in Mecca a couple of months ago, and meteorologists were shocked because it's never rained when it was that hot before. And then just to prove that that isn't anything yet, it rained at 115 degrees in Palm Springs. You know, that they've assumed that we need to limit it to 2 degrees, and 2 degrees is, even if we can limit it to 2 degrees, that looks pretty scary already. But the only way we can limit climate change on that grand scale is by getting massive government decisions by the huge and powerful governments, and that, you know, I love the idea of decentralized grassroots, community-based action, and I think it has a role in everything, everywhere, always. But we also need to be doing this international work and focus, you know, on looking at federal governments and the nation state, as well as the oil corporations, because so much of what's happening is that these governments, while our government is so dominated by the petroleum industry, which is a huge part of our economy, China by its manufacturing sector, which is a huge part of their pollution, and, you know, but there is this kind of, you know, if you go, I'll go, sort of thing, this brinksmanship that happened in Copenhagen and other times. So I don't quite see how we'll move forward. You know, I'm on a panel with a bunch of artists, and I was really curious both what your best case scenario is and how you see your own work as participating in that process, or what that process could look like. I know that's a trick question. Every question is a trick question about climate change.
I'll just say my last piece here, and then I'll leave the panel to you. So for me, what I've done with this project, where I've tried to create a clean air park. First, I was involved with emissions trading and trying to keep emissions in small amounts from being emitted, and therefore opening up this temporary clean air park. But that just created a very small park. Whether I was keeping 24 pounds of NOx from being emitted or 50 tons of carbon dioxide. So I decided that it was better to think about the entire atmosphere as a potential park. And so in 2006, I decided to try to begin a process to get Earth's atmosphere listed as a UNESCO World Heritage Site. And that didn't move forward, although there was some interest at the beginning from one of the former people who was head of UNESCO and said that wasn't a bad idea, you know, considering the fact that you have places like Antarctica, right, which is carved up like a pie, and many UNESCO states parties have to be involved potentially in, you know, in agreeing to making it a World Heritage Site. So that was enough for me, and although I'm still struggling with the project, this last year I've moved forward with it with the support of a German art exhibition called Documenta, which is going on now in Germany, and it has a very large audience. It's expecting between 750 to 850,000 attendees during the 3 months it's open. So I use the platform as an opportunity to have the curator of that exhibition first go to Germany and ask if they would lead a nomination process, and they said no. So that was opened up to all states parties, and most of them didn't reply to our letter of invitation. However, the Kingdom of Tonga did, and they were interested, as you might imagine, considering, you know, where they're situated, but they lacked the resources. And I think this speaks to, you know, when you talk about states and their, you know, equal powers in terms of climate negotiations, you know, obviously that gives sort of the, you know, you can see the lie there and that and the sort of uneven bargaining power. So that said, you know, and thinking about the terms of thinking about publics and thinking about an audience as a possible public, I went to the audience there and asked if they would sign a petition asking their respective governments to reconsider. And a lot of people have signed these postcards. 50,000 attendees who are German citizens signed the postcards, and these were all sent last week to the German Ministry of the Environment. I'm not sure if anything will come of it, but I think it's interesting to think about this idea about an audience potentially mobilizing or at least seeing themselves as a possible unified force in terms of thinking about wanting something to move forward. So I guess that's how I'm thinking about the problem of the nation state and hoping that maybe there can be a larger solution, which would be a protected atmosphere and the benefits that that gives everyone.
Best case scenario?
I thought you were going next.
No, I'm just looking straight at you.
Best case scenario. I think I've been so focused on the worst case scenario lately that the best case scenario hasn't even occurred to me. Isn't that sad? Best case scenario is for grandiose systemic change and, you know, mountain lions to take over the country. I'm not sure what it is. I think I really don't know. That stumps me more than probably anything right now.
I kind of.
Wow.
David, jump in with
David,
mine. Yeah,
go ahead
no,
and be unstumped.
I want to follow up with something Amy said about artists. I mean, what is interesting about getting artists or any of the creative folk involved in this is that we all come up with ideas and dialogues, but what an artist then takes it takes it to another level. They bash it into shape, whether it's through words or through painting, and they really have to craft the narrative and make it much more succinct so that they take on board all of this information, the idea, you know, a glimpse of an idea that's so far out that they have to drag it back into some form that they can then make it malleable and then be able to articulate it into a concise form. And I find that process, and I don't mind whether it's music or architecture or writing or painting, it's a very, very, you know, exciting process to actually watch, but actually then when it exists, it's a very, very powerful tool of communication. And it also, it doesn't just depend on the rational, it actually speaks to our emotional selves, and I'm a great believer in emotional knowledge, that actually we have this capability of emotional knowledge. So I think that the more that happens, the better it is. I'm just going to quickly on the Rebecca side.
Yeah, go ahead.
We need legislation. I mean, there have been very best. I mean, the English have just passed a law about reducing carbon levels drastically by 2025, and it's now a law. So in order to it not to happen, somebody has to revoke that law, which is very, very difficult. Ontario passed a law 5 years ago promising to decarbonize the whole of the state of the power generation of the province of Ontario. And they just went to election and managed just to squeak through and hold on to that. Interestingly, the best case that they gave in order to convince the public was to align climate to health. Like, really don't live downwind of a coal-fired power station. It's really bad to your health. There are so many issues in this where it is actually going to affect our health very, very badly. And that's on a personal level. So I think that by aligning climate and health, I think it's a very, very strong kind of argument which was used. And legislation, legislation, legislation. We need laws. And we really do.
I think the answer to most either or questions is both. So cultural change and legislation, yes, please. And I think we have another question or statement from the audience. Please come up.
Hi, my name is Catherine, and mine's more of a comment, I guess, and I agree with what Amy and David just said about pressure and also legislation. And I think that when we talk about these terrifying numbers or terrifying math, I think one of the reasons why it is terrifying and then you put the article down or walk away from the film or whatever it is and then feel frustrated is because I think that the numbers don't matter until they really hit our pocketbooks. Right now, people are having a hard time buying food, but until, say, gas and so many of the other things are really not subsidized by our governments in this form of, like, subsidizing, say, corn and all of these other things that we don't have we don't play with real math when it comes to buying clothes, buying gas, buying a lot of our food even. So I think until those numbers are real on a personal level, that disconnect will always be there. And I think it would, and the only way to get there, I think, is through pressure, and that whether that be protest or boycotts, or my preference would be through voting and voting in the proper people to help, you know, make these legislative changes in order for us to work with real numbers. So that's all.
Thank you. You know, I think we are facing a massive food famine. It's the fact that so much of the corn crop in the United States has failed because of the heat this summer is pretty shocking. And it's worth remembering that things like a lot of what triggered the Arab Spring was hunger and poverty, which was partly about economic inequality, about systems that created gratuitous poverty when there might be enough, and was partly about real rises in food prices tied to climate in some cases. And I think that there's going to be, you know, and the best case scenario for me would be that those kind of pressures of the rising costs, the dropping standard of living, which we're having for a lot of people in this country too, pushes those kind of democratic revolutions that produce more accountable and democratic regimes, something closer to real democracy than we and a lot of other countries have right now. But you know, that's my usual political hat, which might not be that interesting at this point. We're coming near the end. I'm wondering if anybody wants to talk about, well, we do have somebody, about some of the things going on in Marfa or West Texas or,
you know, and I'm going to give the panelists a chance to say more before we close.
Sure. Yeah, this is not a question about West Texas, but I want to pick up, given that this is a panel of artists who are focused in this arena, on David, on your comment of a couple of minutes ago. Clearly the opportunity for artists who are focused in this arena, as the three of you slash four of you are, is to develop a visual, high-impact visual way to communicate, because we do have a failure to communicate, right? There is a group of people who know what's going on, who are steeped in the progression of our environment and climate, but the general population isn't there. And, you know, we live in a world where, you know, the picture is worth not 1,000 words anymore, probably worth 1,000,000 words. And yet, notwithstanding the advances that have been made, at least from my perspective, no one has quite hit it yet in terms of developing this really extraordinarily successful way to translate all of this to a set of visual images or a visual language that then gets the point across. So I guess my questions to the panel are, number one, you know, why hasn't this occurred yet? B, what are the most promising either people or projects underway right now that have a chance of breaking through that? And, you know, what is your kind of prognosis for that development as artists working in this field?
I think that's a very tall order for an artist. But I do think that maybe a cumulative approach is more what we need to look for, looking for kind of an emblematic image that inspires solution. I don't know that will happen, but having issues around climate be in cultural dialogue, well integrated into arts and literature, and I think, you know, having that kind of, maybe having it be less special and less spectacular and more just pervasive is what we need. You know, having that be part of every conversation in a sense. And I think here on the panel you have three examples of people that take very different approaches with this topic, and I think we probably all dabble in things that aren't even remotely climate change related. I mean, Amy's project, as she said, is very direct and deals with kind of looking at systems and engaging in international systems where she can actually possibly affect change or lobby for change or give some example for that. David is, you know, a brilliant curator and organizer for bringing together all kinds of artists and inspiring and inciting conversation in public forums. And I think I deal a lot more in poetics, which is very indirect and, you know, may or may not be activism, but is probably, each language probably speaks differently to different individuals. You know, some might respond to what I do and some might respond to what Amy does. And I think that kind of more broad network is probably the most effective.
I mean, just the world of artists has changed so much in the last 10, 15 years. I mean, we're just doing so many different things with practice, less involved in making objects, but actually, you know, just the three of us here trying to interrogate something which is of crucial importance to us, but also maybe of global significance. I mean, just in the K4OL project, I never expected it to be what it is. And over 150 artists have embedded themselves in the project and have come up with ways of seeing the world that I couldn't imagine. And that has always been an endless delight to me. I'm always excited by the way an artist will grab hold of a particular piece of information and fight with it and target it and actually create something. And that process, I wish it would accelerate. I mean, we're doing a lot of work with universities now. You know, the universities, the art school, they have the responsibility of teaching the next generation of artists. And, you know, what is that going to be? You know, is it the status quo, or are they moving that territory? So we're doing a lot of work. And it's partly in response to the, you know, the 18-year-olds, the 20-year-olds are coming going, well, wait a minute, I want my art to actually have some kind of relevance to the way I live, much more fundamentally than if I would, you know, than used to be expected from an artist. So I think that's a big cultural shift and a very exciting one, and one that gives me enormous hope. And, you know, the way that then gets teased and put into, I mean, you know, thank you, Ballroom, very, very much. Thank you, Martha. You've allowed us this platform to, in order to kind of express what we do. And I think the more that that happens, and I'm really, truly grateful for this opportunity. So, I, you know, great, but I think there is a big change happening. And I think artists are probably just part of that change. I mean, I think this, I mean, Diana's going to probably talk about it. Scientific community has changed heaps and bounds in the last 10, 15 years. Become much more vocal, willing to step up and actually become, I mean, be, take on the dialogue and the media and find ways of communicating what they do. So there are lots of changes that are happening.
I think we have one more member of the audience who wants to say something, and then we should probably get around to wrapping it up.
Amy's conversation on the war there, the images that we saw in Vietnam was the last time we really made major changes to the war. The young girl screaming down the street with phosphorus on it, My Lai images. And the other day I was driving down the road and I was listening to someone talk about taking tour groups into Chernobyl. And I said, David, why aren't you taking tour groups up tar sands? And why am I not taking tour groups into the Houston Petrochemical, 1,069 plants along the coast? And here in West Texas, you got the largest nuclear dump in the country. Up here in Andrews, Texas, which is a short distance from Odessa, the fires that came out of Fort Davis not long ago came very close to it. Everybody in the country was really upset that Los Alamos may catch on fire. Well, Andrews, Texas could have caught on fire a lot easier, and nobody knows about it. You These know, are the type of things that we could do. Maybe tourism is a better way of protest than the way we're doing.
You know, I completely agree with you. You know, I agree with you, and that's what I was trying to do in Invisible Five, and who we collaborated with was Green Action for Environmental Health and Justice, who work on questions of, like, dumping of nuclear radioactive waste in poor communities across the West. And, you know, the toxic tour model, right? You know, you take people to these sites, and you network, and you create this broader understanding. You know, I think in terms of that, you know, we're a society that values automobility. You know, now we have the ability to listen to, you know, media distributed through podcasts, you know, on Android phones. You can have it geolocated. And I think that's great. You know, if somebody who's here is interested in doing that kind of project, you know, of West Texas, I think that would be a really exciting and trenchant project.
Sign me up for your tour.
It just does take ecotourism to a completely new level.
Yeah.
But it's interesting, Kate Fairwood, you know, we went to the far-flung places of the planet. We're actually looking much more at urban centers. You know, how do you interrogate economy? How do you interrogate, you know, the other parts of our society? And again, you say tar sands, but I mean, there are so many, you know, fracking. I mean, you know, Adrian just went up to Midland. It wasn't so far, but in a way, that's the process. The other one, though, the whole world of climate is a really difficult target. You know, I mean, I think when you're objecting to the Vietnamese war, you have a fixed something that's right there in front of you that you have to kind of address, but the climate target is just very soft and malleable, and where's the measurable change? How do you know you succeeded? And I think that's what makes it very, very complicated for us to pick up. And I think that's a big challenge to us all.
And I would also like to add one thing about media and how media has changed since Vietnam is that, you know, during Vietnam, you actually had access, you know, you had actual access by journalists to what was happening. And I know that, I think it was in the 80s, I'm not sure if it was with the Falklands, I think that there was limited access. Then you ended up, of course, you know, with the model that we have now where you actually have, you know, what is it, embedded journalists who aren't able to actually bring back those images because they're controlled. And so, you know, I wonder about, like, you know, what kind of new journalism will we see that may bring those kind of images that may help provoke that kind of response?
And I, sorry.
Oh, go ahead.
Just to bring it a little bit full circle, because we were talking about this in the beginning, I think, you know, you touch on something that's about, that connects to what we want to see and what we don't want to see in our society. There's a lot of kind of invisible elements that we, you know, we would rather have our blinders onto, or that maybe we just incidentally have blinders to because they're not sort of on display. And I think that follows through into issues around climate change. There's a lot we kind of don't really look at and don't really take head on. So
it's interesting to think of climate change as a war in which there are some things that are inaccessible, but there's not so many embedded reporters, and it could be, you know, it can be reported on and is being reported on pretty well, but it's, you know, it's so vast. There are so many facets. You know, there's so many aspects, and we could go on from there, but it's 1:30, or it's 2:30. And so I think all we leave you with is questions. What is the role of culture versus legislation? What's your best case in your worst scenario? What should you be doing with your own life? What is the role of artists? What does it mean to be a citizen? What are you going to do next? And other than come back for the fantastic science panel at 3 o'clock. Thank you so much.
Thank you.